Welcome to Discover Library and Archives Canada, your history, your documentary heritage. I'm your guest host, Beth Greenhorn. Join us as we showcase treasures from our vaults, guide you through our many services, and introduce you to the people who acquire, safeguard, and make known Canada's documentary heritage. $0.15. That was the price of admission to a garish world of purple prose and smoking guns, of square-jawed cowboys, relentless mounties, and world-weary police detectives, of time travel, eldritch horrors, and far-flung planets, of body cartoons, tragic love, romantic lumberjacks, and women both virtuous and vengeful. It was the world of the pulp magazines. In this episode, we explore our unique and one of the very few known collections of Canadian pulp magazines that Library and Archives Canada started to acquire in 1996, and their rise and fall in the 1940s and into the early 1950s. Our guests today are Ian Driscoll, author and contributor of Library and Archives Canada's website, Tales from the Vault, and joining us by phone from Australia is Dr. Caroline Strange, co-author of True Crime, True North, The Golden Age of Canadian Pulp Magazines. Hi, Ian. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'd like to start by asking, how did you become interested in pulp magazines and this type of material to begin with?
Well, I mean, growing up on movies and comic books and Star Wars and Indiana Jones and sort of B-movies on the late-night television, you know, Godzilla movies and that sort of thing, all the cheap, bad genre entertainment that the world could throw at me, I sort of loved it. And then, you know, growing up, getting to university or, you know, high school, university, and being curious about where these things came from, I sort of traced them back and did some reading and learned about the pulp magazines. And I sort of knew characters like The Shadow and Doc Savage from comic books, which is where they ended up. And then discovered after that they had originally come from pulp magazines. And actually my grandfather actually had a few pulp magazines kicking around in his basement. When I went to visit him, I could pull them down off of the shelf and flip through them. And, you know, some of them came apart in my hands, but it was, you know, they had that weird musty smell of sitting in a basement for 50 years or whatever, but it was sort of a fascinating and direct connection with the past. And they had those crazy garish covers that are really attractive to a kid as well. They were designed to be cheap to buy, even cheaper to produce, and disposable. They're called pulp magazines because of the cheap pulp paper that they were printed on, which had a very high acid content, so it tended to discolor and become brittle very quickly and break down, which is why there aren't a lot of the magazines left around, as they tended to decay and fall apart. And it's another reason that the Library and Archives collection is so special and such an amazing resource, is just because there are very few of these things still around. But the idea was to, you know, spend your dime and get your entertainment for the week and then, you know, toss it out. Not a lot of people kept stacks of these things around. They weren't, you know, lined up on the shelf like your National Geographics or anything like that.
So, Carolyn, can you tell us a little about how the Canadian pulp industry came to be?
Prior to the 1940s, there were all kinds of different ways in which publishers fed the appetite for spicy stories. And they were in dime novels, they were in police procedurals, so again, cheap publications. And most people in Canada would have read what would that later become known as pulp magazines that were Canadian. Prior to the 1940s, they would have read primarily American true crime magazines with, you know, garish covers, etc. It feeds on what had already been an interest in both true crime and fiction, but it gets a Canadian stamp by the 1940s.
The Canadian pulp publishing industry really, really was born because of the War Exchange Conservation Act that was passed. around World War II, which banned the import of luxury items from the U.S. And among the things that was banned for importation, the things that were banned for importation were any periodicals. I'm just going to quote here: any periodicals featuring detective, sex, Western, and alleged true or confession stories. So basically, all the genres that the pulp magazines, the American pulp magazines, were dealing in. So when he passed that, when they passed that legislation, William Lyon Mackenzie King sort of became the unwitting father of the Canadian pulp industry, because with all those things banned from importation from the States, we needed to, a homegrown industry had to spring up to fill the demand. I mean, they tried for a little while with doing reprints and buying stories from American authors and publishing them here, but they just couldn't keep up with the demand. So they had to start sourcing homegrown talent and getting their stories from Canadian authors and getting their covers done by Canadian painters and that sort of thing.
Yes, and that's something that was not in the legislators' minds when they banned the importation of these American magazines. They didn't think that a Canadian industry would mushroom overnight, actually.
So during the height and flourish of mm-hmm. the Canadian pulp fiction industry, how did our identity differ, or did it differ from those stories that were being printed and produced in the United States?
A lot of the magazines were very similar to what was being published in America. It's the same sort of genres of, like I said, there were crime and detective stories and sort of sex and true confession and romance stories, horror, science fiction, all those things, that were very similar to the American pulp magazines, but then going through the collection, I also found a few examples of times where the magazines were trying to establish a Canadian identity or looking for what set them apart from their American counterparts. Mm-hmm. It was in particular in one of the science fiction pulps, which I don't have the title in front of me here. Anyways, you can find it easily if you go onto the collection website.
That's right.
There's a whole section about this. They were very interested in, from an editorial stance, from trying to find out what would make Canadian science fiction or Canadian speculative fiction different from American speculative fiction. There was a whole editorial in one of the magazines that talked about how, I'm going to quote again here, Canada is different. Canadiana may appreciate the modern American science fiction story, but is not exactly that which speaks for the Canadian. The situation is different. Because the way the publishers of the magazine saw it, it was all about history. They thought America, the United States, being very much tied to its past. They thought all of its significant achievements were in the past, were completed, and Canada was a nation of unrealized potential, one that would continue to evolve. They said, I'll just quote again here, Canada, as I have said, has no past. It has only a future. Canada has not been completely conquered and colonized as the United States has. Only her southern fringe is inhabited as befits a nation. Her vast resources to the northern regions are almost untouched. Where are the great cities of the north? Where are the railroads running to the very Arctic regions? Where are the motor highways that make available the wealth of land around the Great Slave Lake? They do not exist. They are in the future. Does any man doubt that they shall exist someday? Does any man believe that it is beyond the ability of man to develop these lands? That while we may fly to the moon and colonize Venus, which must be 1,000 times more uninviting than northern Canada, we shall never hold and use these territories? So,
wow.
Yeah. I think Venus might be a little rougher to colonize than northern Canada.
But I would say yes.
Yeah. I think the pulp magazines didn't have a lot of time. They only had that like 10, maybe 12 or 15 year mm-hmm. run where they really existed and flourished. So they didn't have a lot of time to develop their own Canadian identity, but they were definitely striving towards it. And like I said, when they started developing their own stories, you know, telling true crime stories set in Winnipeg or Vancouver or something like that, it was the beginning of that, you know, that whole idea of telling our own stories rather than just repeating American stories or reading American stories secondhand.
Mm-hmm.
We were, you know, it was Canadian characters in recognizable Canadian locations, dealing with Canadian laws and Canadian assumptions. There was also another genre that existed in the Canadian pulp magazines that didn't really exist in the Americans, which was the Northern, which is sort of a Canadian version of the Western, except it replaces the cowboy or the sheriff with usually an RCMP officer up in the Yukon or the Northwest Territories or something like that, and sort of dealing with that, you know, dogged pursuit of justice, much like you see in the Westerns, but in a recognizably Canadian setting.
Definitely, and there's one of the covers that comes to mind, too, is the mm-hmm. Mountie, you know, wearing his red jacket.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's very, it's like iconic Canadian.
Very much so.
Symbol.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that not a lot of, like, great characters came out of the Canadian pulp industry, or at least not the English Canadian pulp industry. The French, the pulp industry in Quebec was a little bit different, but there weren't a lot of continuing stories or continuing characters in English Canada. There were a lot of anthologies and one-off stories and that sort of thing. So you don't get something like The Shadow or Doc Savage or anything mm-hmm. anything on that level in Canadian. In English Canadian, anyways, pulp fiction, which is interesting and curious.
Yeah, and in fact, I wanted to ask you really, talk about the differences between English and French Canadian mm-hmm. pulp fiction. And I mean, I guess you touched on one of them with the characters, and you know, building that up and having, you know, a continuing storyline.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there were a lot of the pulp magazines that were published in Quebec were about specific characters and their continuing adventures. There was Max Beaumont, the inassailable adventurer. I'm just translating from the mm-hmm. French, but there was the strange adventures of Agent IXE-13, the ace of Canadian spies. Those kinds of guys, and they were very Quebecois, and they were investigating mysteries and intrigue and everything in Quebec, and you know, around some, you know, the eastern townships and the east coast of Canada, but you know, in very very recognizable French Canadian settings, and again dealing with, you know, French Canadian intrigue and French Canadian laws and all those sorts of things. So they were very Quebecois, but they had this kinship with American pulp heroes that, like I said, like the Shadow mm-hmm. or the Spider or Doc Savage or, you know, Operator 5 or any one of those characters that's more well known. But also borrowed a lot from the European characters that came from, say, France or Italy, characters like Fantomas or Arsène Lupin, that sort of, mm-hmm. those sort of things. Physically, the Quebec pulp magazines were different. They were smaller in size. Mm-hmm. They were maybe about half the size of an English Canadian pulp magazine, and about half the length usually as well. And they were almost always a single story. So, and they were often published weekly as well.
That's a lot of material
It is a lot of material
to pump out every week. I didn't realize that they were published and produced that often.
Yeah, yeah. They called them fascicule there, which is a pamphlet or a booklet,
okay.
as opposed to a pulp magazine. And they were almost all had black and white covers, or it was black and white with one color, so not the big garish fully painted covers that you would see on the Canadian English Canadian pulp magazines.
Right. Some of the covers are quite shocking and colorful, What was the reason behind this?
I mean, yeah, it's the magazines, the covers were designed to help sell, basically. They were designed to, when they were sitting on the shelf at the corner store or the magazine stand or whatever, you know, they wanted to scream at people walking by and say, you know, if you buy this magazine, you're going to see sex and you're going to see violence and you're going to read about, you know, some shocking true crime, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So they really were designed to, you know, appeal to your basest instincts and, you know, your, you know, to see behind the curtain and see the stuff you're not supposed to see.
Carolyn, who are the readers of these magazines and books?
Well, it's very difficult to map the audience, but there are suggestive pieces of information that we found. So when we looked at the NLA's wonderful collection, it's not just the magazines themselves, but some of the files of, you know, just the industry files. So how are we doing with sales to, you know, certain sectors of our readership? And we found some letters to the editor which were quite revealing. So they came from men and women. Some of them were, you know, very well written, so it's not like some poorly educated scrawl on a scrap of paper. They would be typewritten, so that implies that there's a cross-class appeal. But they were distributed. We know that they were distributed primarily to newsstands, and so it wouldn't be you wouldn't go to a highbrow bookstore and find these for sale. But that does not mean that if you're at a train station and you're a fancy businessman or you're a lady going to a concert that evening, that you might not have just spared a dime or 20 cents or 15 cents and tucked it into your purse or into your briefcase.
Mm-hmm.
So they had an appeal across class, but they were primarily oriented and associated with a working class and lower middle class audience.
Yeah, from what we can tell, it was sort of like they were cheap enough that anyone could buy them, and there was a genre to appeal to everyone. You know, whether you were interested in science fiction or horror or westerns, or there were entire pulp magazines about sports stories, and or you wanted romance or whatever you were interested in, there was, you know, you could buy a couple hundred pages a month or a couple hundred pages a week to read and entertain yourself with.
Pulp is just the medium. Anything could be printed on it, and anything was. So in the same way that we would now walk into a bookstore and we could go to a true crime section, there'll often be sections that are quite explicitly labeled that way. 50, 75 years ago, we would have gone to a newsstand and just seen a bunch of cheap magazines that conveyed the same kinds of stories, but in shorter forms. However, today we would also go to a crime fiction section in the same bookstore. So both deal with themes that are quite similar, such as the love gone wrong theme,
mm-hmm.
The heist that goes wrong, the detective who cracks a case, etc. But there are some that actually happen and some that are works of fiction.
So we talked about the covers, but I was wondering, Ian, if you could touch on and perhaps comment on the advertisements these magazines were publishing and how they differed from newspapers at the time.
Yeah, I mean, because the pulp magazines were a little more, they were a little less for public consumption, they were a little more targeted at an adult audience, the advertisements were definitely aimed at a more adult audience as well. I mean, you still had innocuous ads in there for all sorts of like home gadgets and that sort mm-hmm. of thing. But they also offered a lot of things that would be delivered in plain brown wrappers, if you know what I mean. There were a lot of ads for art books about how to draw from the nude. So it would be photographs mm-hmm. of nude models that you would ostensibly be using for artistic reference. And
mm-hmm.
the ads had, you know, in big type that these would only be sold to art students or adults. books with information about contraception, which was technically illegal at the time to provide that if you weren't a doctor. So it was very risque, and those would only be sold to adults or married couples. I don't know how they established who was a married couple or not, but you could send away and get this delivered to you. There were ads for aphrodisiac perfumes and stories of lesbian love and all sorts of risque things that you would never be caught dead buying in a store, you know, where one of your friends or neighbors might see you, but you could send away and get this delivered to you. And I guess since they were advertising in the pulps, it was reasonably, I mean, it was good in advertising terms. I guess it was good target marketing because you knew that the people who were buying these magazines were already interested in sex and violence and all these, you know, all these sorts of tawdry things. So why not sell them some more?
Are you aware of any instances where any of the books might have been banned if they had sort of crossed that line?
I'm not sure of a specific instance, although I know that Al Valentine, who was one of the largest publishers of pulp magazines, really started in the business because he was doing a favor for a couple of other publishers who were facing morals charges. They weren't able to actually print their magazines because they were, I'm not sure exactly what it was, but they were facing some sort of morals charge about the content of their magazine. Mm-hmm. He had just been a printer up to that point. He, as a favor to them, he printed their magazine for them sort of on the sly and then saw how well it sold and how much money there was to be made in it and realized that he should just go into business for himself as a publisher since he already owned the printing presses. And over the next few years, he bought up all the little publishers that he could get his hands on, all the content, all the magazine lines, and in a few short years, he became like the largest publisher of pulp magazines in Canada. And a lot of the collection that's at the library and archives comes from his company.
And I understand that the collection is, I guess, referred to now as a Valentine collection.
As the Valentine collection.
Unofficial Valentine collection.
Yes, the Valentine collection for him, Al Valentine and Al Val Publications.
Early on, you mentioned, you know, the impact that Pulp Fiction has had on TV and in movies. And again, I'm just wondering if you could comment a little bit further on its lasting impact and how it's, you know, manifested itself in it, you know, parts of it have, you know, continued.
Right, its spores are still out there.
Yes,
for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the more interesting ones is the that I discovered was that Harlequin Romance really got its start by buying up huge swaths of romance pulps, particularly in Canada. They bought those collections of romance stories, those whole libraries of those things, and started republishing those as the basis for their story before they were, you know, commissioning original work. And, you know, Harlequin is still a huge industry today and has spawned, you know, who knows how many other romance lines and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's one sort of strain that sort of directly led into, you know, modern day life. And, you know, I think it's still finding expression in things like 50 Shades of Grey or whatever like that. Definitely, I mean, the true crime genre sort of started in the pulp magazine. I mean, there was crime reporting before that, but, you know, it sort of started there before Truman Capote got a hold of it with In Cold Blood. But That sort of strain still runs through a lot of popular culture. You know, you still see movies of the week based on true crimes and, you know, sort of ripped from the headline TV shows, the Law and Order and any other sort of police procedural will sooner or later get to the point where it's like pulling stories from the real world and fictionalizing them and exploiting them for entertainment value.
Who were the writers of these pulp magazines and books?
That's a good question, and it's really difficult to know in a lot of cases because a lot of them were using pseudonyms and writing under a bunch of different names. And a lot of them, frankly, weren't putting a lot of care or effort into the work that they were doing because they just had to crank it out just to make a living. The sense that I got is that a lot of them were newspaper reporters who were doing this on the side during, I guess, slow news weeks. They would, they, or, you know, at the end of the day, they would go home and write a 50-page story overnight and send it off to the magazines the next day. Or, they were magazine writers who were just like doing this on the side as, I don't think it was ever a terribly respectable sort of profession. So there weren't a lot of them that stood up and said,
I'm the author of this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And again, in the Canadian industry, it wasn't like there were there was a specific author who was identified with a really popular character because we didn't have a lot of those continuing stories. So you wouldn't have like, it's the guy who created The Shadow. Or something like that. It wouldn't.
So I guess it goes on both sides too. You, if you were the author, you weren't claiming, you know, that a penship or that, that you were the author of a particular book, and at the same time, readers might not be waving their novels up, saying, "Hey, you know, I'm reading this Pulp Fiction book either." So.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was. Yeah, it wasn't a terribly respectable profession, and it wasn't something that reading the pulp magazines wasn't necessarily something that polite people did. I guess I should say it's not that it wasn't something that polite people didn't do. Maybe it was something that polite people didn't admit to doing.
You know, after 1952, when this medium started to die out in Canada, what was the impact, and why did that happen?
Well, I mean, there were a couple of factors that really led to the decline of the pulp. So the first was that in after World War II, the War Exchange Conservation Act was repealed. It was briefly replaced by another act, but that was repealed as well. And once the Canadian economy was stable enough, all the American pulp magazines started flowing back across the border. And you know, the Canadian pulps just couldn't compete. They didn't have the, you know, the giant publishing companies behind them, and they didn't have the big popular characters that you would hear about The Shadow on the radio and you want to read The Shadow magazine. So they didn't have the name recognition and the money and the size behind them.
I understand that you were heavily involved with the content development for Library and Archives Canada's website, Tales from the Vault. I'm wondering if you can tell us about the website and more of what it was about.
It was really, the website is an opportunity to sort of like peer inside the Library and Archives pulp art and fiction collection, which is, it's one of the very few pulp magazine collections in all of Canada, especially that contains Canadian content. The Canadian pulp magazines contains a lot of magazines, but there are also original manuscripts, which are fascinating. Cover art, proofs of covers, and photos and newspapers and magazine clippings all about pulp fiction. So there are also some, you know, pocket novels and serials. It's all sort of content that was written between like 1940 and 1952, around there.
Well, this has been very, very interesting. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to have had a chance to come back and revisit this. This is one of the more interesting projects that I've ever had a chance to work on. So,
well, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about Library and Archives Canada's pulp collection, please visit us online at bac-lac.gc.ca. On our homepage, select Discover the Collection and then select Literature. On this page, you will find a link to our web exhibition, Tales from the Vault. Be sure to also consult the page for this episode on our podcast website to find our list of English and French pulp titles that you can use to search our library search engine. Thank you for joining us. I'm your guest host, Beth Greenhorn, and you've been listening to Discover Library and Archives Canada, where Canadian history, literature, and culture await you. A special thanks to our guests today, Ian Driscoll and Carolyn Strange. For more information about our podcast, or if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please visit us at bac-lac.gc.ca/podcasts.